Good evening, everyone. I think we'll try and make a start. Last week we spent time giving an introduction and moving into the first habit. Today we're going to try and cover habit two and habit three, which really, in a way, do go together because they're actually two sides of the same coin, as we'll soon see. So, just to briefly summarize from last week we covered habit one. Habit one was be proactive, the concept that we are responsible and we choose our own responses. So yes, we might be influenced by our genetics, our upbringing, our environment, but at the end of the day, we choose how we respond. And we developed some of those skills. So we talked about believing, the attitude, belief that we can actually do it. We talked about the pause button. Now, when we do have this issue where we want to respond negatively, the emotional instinctive response that is negative might be very quick because it comes from the emotional part of our being, the animalistic part of our being, whereas the response which is more rational comes from the more godly side, and we have to give it time to kick in. So we talked about that commitment of just putting on the pause button just for a few seconds. We talked about a very important thing about focusing on one's circle of influence, not one's circle of concern, and trying to find meaning in every experience. But the underlying principle of the habit one was that we choose, we make our decisions, we are responsible for ourselves, and we have the ability to make those choices and to make the decisions. We are not forced, and we don't necessarily have to be bound by our instinctive responses. So now we're moving to habit two. Now, habit two is based on the question that if we have the power to choose, the question is, what do we choose? So in other words, habit one is more about the power to choose. Habit two is about what we choose.
Rabbi Gori, could we choose to switch the air conditioner and open the door?
We could.
Is that okay? Some people call
me. Sure, go ahead. Open the door.
Noisy as
well. No problem. We'll give it a try.
Is that okay, everyone?
Yeah.
Is that cool?
Right.
Let's check it out.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Thank you.
Is that closed? Okay, so habit one is about the power to choose. Habit two is what we choose. What I mean by that is as follows. Every situation that we experience has a response. Now sometimes our responses are ineffective because they're instinctive, as we spoke about last week, but sometimes not. Sometimes we choose a response because we're able to choose a response. Every human being can choose a response. But nevertheless, our response might not be in line with our ultimate goal. And therefore, habit two says, begin with the end in mind. Right? That's the habit. Begin with the end in mind. You know, sometimes a person can choose, for example, give a simplistic example. A person can have children, and you can choose to exercise extreme discipline. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm a big advocate of structure and discipline when it comes to children. But the discipline has to be together with love, with bonding, with building a deep and meaningful relationship. So sometimes a person can choose a very cold, strict, firm regime of discipline. It can work. But at the end of the day, it actually doesn't fulfill the goal, because that person's goal might be to have a deep and warm relationship with his children. And the choices that that person made actually don't achieve the goal at the end of the day. And that's why it's so important to begin with the end in mind. I had an interesting episode myself a number of months ago where, and this is why sometimes it's so important to get a sort of an objective assessment or evaluation from someone else, like from a spiritual coach, you know. I had a situation where I was involved in something and I was completely convinced about a certain course of action I should take. It was about talking to someone or standing up for something or whatever the case was. And it was clear to me. It was clear that it was the right decision. It wasn't something that was instinctive. It wasn't impulsive. It was actually a decision that I very carefully thought about and I was going to take. But I decided that before I do it, I will talk to my mentor. Everyone has to have a spiritual mentor. A rabbi has to have a rabbi too. So I spoke to my rabbi, who's a great individual, lives in America. And in 5 minutes, he talked me out of it. He said to me, first of all, you need to understand. He asked me two questions. He says, is the thing you want to do an obligation, halachic obligation? Is it a moral obligation? Is it something you have to do? Because if it is, there are certain absolute moral codes and you need to do them or follow them, whatever the consequence might be. And the answer was, of course, that it wasn't. It was a choice that I was making. It was something that I could do either one way or the other. He says, fine, so let's leave that aside now. Let's examine, does it fit into your goal? Your end goal. You have a mission in Sydney, you have a particular focus, a particular responsibility, it's to educate people, to give shirim, to bring people closer to Jewish wisdom, whatever the case is, what you're going to do is going to fit into your role, or is it going to damage your role? And it ended up, actually, he was right, he was 100% right. It was a wrong decision, it would have been something that would have damaged my role, damaged the ultimate goal. Even though I was so convinced it was the right thing, but what I failed to do is, I hadn't begun with the end in mind. In other words, when I was going through the process of making the decision, I was only focusing on the now. I wasn't actually focusing on, does this fit into the ultimate goal? It was a very defining moment, actually. So, therefore, habit 2 says, when you embark on a process of making a decision, when you want to implement habit 1 and exercise your power, your unique power to respond responsibly and to make a decision, the question you have to ask yourself is, does the decision that I'm making fit into my long-term goal? Begin with the end in mind. And Stephen Covey, in his process of developing the 7 habits, gives a very chilling, a very sobering exercise to kind of implement this habit. And he says, what you need to do is you have to imagine that it's many, many years from now and you're listening to your own eulogy. That's his thing. And he says, what would you want people to say? What would you want people to describe you as? What would be the type of person you would want to have people describe you as? What type of family person were you? What type of spouse were you? What type of parent were you? What type of business associate were you? What type of individual, what type of personality did you live by? And that will help you sort of shape those goals and shape sort of the end, define the end, define the goal, so that you can actually begin with the end in mind. Now, this concept really applies on many levels, because of course we have short-term goals and long-term goals, but nevertheless the concept is to always think of the destination, to understand where am I going, what's the ultimate goal, what I want to accomplish at the end. Because this is the problem where so many people and so many times people focus on the now. They focus on what? The information, the experience, the stimulus, the components of the experience that are affecting me now. And we often tend to forget what is the end goal, what is actually the outcome, what I want to achieve. There's a very famous midrash when the Jews left Egypt and they miraculously were able to leave Egypt and they came to the Red Sea. Came to the Red Sea and they had a tremendous problem. Because they became trapped. The Egyptians were pursuing them from the back. There was a sea in the front. There was nowhere to go, right or left. And they felt very, very trapped. They looked behind them, and they saw that it's really not doing very well. So the Midrash tells us that suddenly the Jewish people split into 4 opinions, 4 groups with 4 different approaches of what to do. Some say the miracle was that there was only 4 groups and not like 4,000 groups. But nevertheless, there were 4 groups. Right? The one group said, it's lost, let's just commit suicide. Let's jump into the sea and end it all. The other said, let's surrender. Look, you know, after all, we spent 210 years in Egypt. Let's just go back and let's just surrender. Third group says, let's fight. Let's fight. Let's stage a war. Let's give it our best shot. And the fourth group said, they were more spiritual. I said, let's pray. And Moses is leading the Jewish nation and he's in a little bit of a quandary. Which group is right? What should he do? He turns to God, communicates with God, and God says they are all wrong. Even the one that says to pray is wrong. Praying is very powerful, but not now. Why? Because God says what every group failed to do is they forgot the goal. When you left Egypt, there was a very clear, specific destination. There was a very clear, specific goal of what was supposed to take place. The entire purpose of leaving Egypt was for the Jewish people to move forward and reach the Mount Sinai. That was the promise from God. That when you leave Egypt, you will arrive at the mountain of Sinai, you will receive the Torah. That's the goal. Keep moving. true, there's a sea in front of you. It's a problem. It's an obstacle we need to overcome. But any solution you come into has to be one that it has the complete goal in the equation. And when he said that, they didn't understand that, but there's a sea. And there was one individual, the Talmud tells us, called Nachshon ben Aminadav, who said, that's it, focus on the goal, let's keep moving. Move towards the goal. He jumped into the sea, and at that point the sea miraculously split, and we have the story of the splitting of the sea. I'm not promising that every time you overcome an obstacle, or you encounter an obstacle, the sea will split for you, but the theme is a very, very important theme. Be focused on the goal. Praying is such an incredible thing. One of the groups said we should pray. But God said, but right now praying is a contradiction to achieving the goal. So keep moving. So let's develop this idea a little bit, this concept of beginning with the end in mind. In every part of the human experience, every part of the human existence, there are two very, very important components. The two components is what Stephen Covey calls, on the one hand, we have direction or leadership. And the second is what he calls management. And they're both very important. And in fact, they emphasize the two habits that we're going to talk about tonight. But right now we're talking about the first one. So we have direction and leadership, and we have what he calls management. And everything that we do to be effective and to be successful needs to happen on both levels. Right? A simple analogy. You build a house. The guiding force, the leadership, the direction of how to build a house is provided by the architect who plans the building. Without a plan, you cannot build. But then, of course, there's management. Management is the implementation. You build the building. A decent builder is able to take the plan, is able to take the script, is able to put it into practice, follow it, and build the house. So there's a plan, there's a blueprint, there's a direction, and then there's the management, which is putting into practice, and the focus on the details. I apologize for this annoying light that just started this afternoon. Unfortunately, I have two left hands, so I have no idea what to do. So I'll have to get... There's a fantastic analogy to all this that Stephen Covey gives. He says you have a ladder and you're climbing and you put it against the wall and you're climbing. The ladder's strong. It's a great ladder. You're climbing. You're making progress. There's one problem. It's the wrong wall. Right. And that's what this habit is about. Management in isolation is useless. You need the ladder, but if it's on the wrong wall, it's a problem. If you go into a car, you might be driving very well. The GPS might be working fantastically, but if you've typed in the wrong address, you're going the wrong way. If you're reading the wrong map, you're going in the wrong direction. So the concept, therefore, behind this habit is that before you can start, before you can embark on an experience, there has to be a sort of a longer term, a sort of a broader look, understanding what is the script that I'm following? What is the plan that I'm working on, off? What is the address that I'm driving towards? You know, going back to it's the wrong time of the year, but going back to the time that the Jews left Egypt. So we know that they left Egypt and they counted 49 days until they got to the Mount Sinai. Now we too, between the festival of Pesach and Shavuot, there's a mitzvah called counting the Omer. From the second night of Pesach, we count 49 days until we reach the festival of Shavuot. Now, there's a very interesting halachic debate, which I'm not going to spend this session in fully analyzing it, because that's not relevant to the context of what we're talking about. But I'm just going to share with you the enough that we're able to bring out this concept. There's a very fascinating halachic debate about the mitzvah of counting the Omer, counting the 49 days. And the debate is it one unit? In other words, is it one mitzvah to count all 49 days in succession? Or is every day a specific mitzvah? I'll give you just a little bit of a glimpse into the halachic analysis of this concept. Because, for example, let's say a person performed this mitzvah every night, counted 1, 2, 3, 4, and then missed out the fifth night. Right? The question is, can they now continue with the sixth night? Because if it's one unit, then they've messed it up. You need all 49 nights. If it's every night is a specific, independent, isolated mitzvah, so it's irrelevant what happened last night. Even though I didn't count last night, I can still count tonight. Okay, that's the halachic side of this debate. But in this analysis, whether this mitzvah is one unit of counting 49 days or 49 specific units of counting the Omer, there's a great philosophical idea behind this. And the philosophical idea behind these two parts of the argument is these two components of leadership and management, direction and management. Because it's two perspectives on time. When we're going through each day, when we're going through an experience, when we're planning, when we're counting the days, right? On the one hand, we have to view time as one unit. We have to see what is the overall goal, what is the 49 days as one goal. Where am I getting to? Where am I headed to? Where am I going to land up at the end of these 49 days? But then, of course, and we'll develop that a bit more in detail soon, there's the concept of management, of what we actually do each day. And that's the management part of the experience. But for now, we're emphasizing the first part. The first part is that concept of developing the goal, beginning with the end in mind, understanding that the choices that we make because we're able to make choices, the decisions that we make because we're able to make decisions, what are those decisions based on? Are they based on the now, or are they based on a goal, a destination, a direction where we want to be headed? So let's develop this a little bit. The first thing we need to do is, of course, create an awareness. Once we understand what this habit says, we need to develop a mindset where we create an awareness of our goals. Okay? How do we create an awareness of our goals? We begin with writing a mission statement. We actually, every single person needs a private, individual sort of mission statement. You need to know, where am I heading? What are the driving forces in my life? But then comes the question is, how do we develop this mission statement? What actually are we talking about when we talk about the goal? What do we mean when we talk about the end in mind? What is that end? How do we define that end? To understand how to write this mission statement, we need to understand the following. We need to understand that every person operates on three levels. We operate on the level of behavior, that's part one, which means it's what we think, what we say, and how we act. That's the first level, the level of behavior. The second layer of our existence is the emotions, what I refer to as the tools that drive our behavior. Now, let me stop there and digress for a minute so you understand this clearly. There's a section of the Talmud called the Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avot, which talks about ethics and values and morals, etc. And there's a very interesting passage there, and the passage says the following. It says that there are three things that I'll literally translate the passage for you so you understand where I'm going to go with this. It says there are three things that take a person out of the world, which seems to be reading as there are three things that destroy a human being. What are those three things? Jealousy, lust, and pursuit of glory. Right? Now we can understand. Jealousy, lust, and pursuit of glory, of course, are very destructive emotions, very destructive drivers. And they can destroy a person. Corporations, countries, institutions, people, individuals, the microcosm and the macrocosm have been destroyed and distorted because of jealousy and lust. There's no question, a pursuit of glory. But there was a great philosopher called the Maharal of Prague, who lived about 400 to 450 years ago. And he said the following. He said that in essence, if you take these three things, jealousy, lust, and pursuit of glory, and retranslate them a little bit, you will actually see that not necessarily are they bad things. Not only not necessarily are they bad things, but the Maharal submitted the following. He said that in fact, these are the three tools that are critical to human function. Absolutely critical for human function. Depending on how they're used, of course. On the one hand, they are so powerful that they can destroy a human being. On the other hand, they are actually the three ingredients that are absolutely critical for human function. When we translate in Hebrew, the word is for lust is ta'ava. Now, of course, if you translate it as lust, it has a very negative connotation. But the real exact translation is desire. Lust is a negative form of desire. The will, the ratzon, the will of a human being. A person that wakes up in the morning and does not have a fully functional, strong desire for anything, remains in bed, is a depressed person. So the foundation of the human function is will, is ta'ava, is lust. You must have it to function. When that functionality is developed to some level of effective success, you need jealousy, but not in a negative way. You need some level of healthy competition. You need some level of benchmarking. The Talmud says, jealousy among the scholars increases wisdom. In other words, there's some sort of aspiration. You see someone who has something good, you aspire to have it, not necessarily to take it away from them, not necessarily to compete in a negative way, but you learn, you aspire, you desire for something higher. That's a healthy form of jealousy. It's critical to human function. It's critical to human success. And then even the third one called pursuit of glory. Pursuit of glory, he says, it depends how it's done. If it's an empty pursuit of honor, it's terrible, it's destructive. But if it's a healthy pursuit of one developing a healthy sense of self, a healthy self-esteem, a healthy perception of one's own worth, it's not only important, not only good, it's critical. People are held back, people are trapped, because they have a negative perception of themselves, because they have insecurity, because they cannot function, because they doubt themselves all the time. It is critical to human function to understand that we have an intrinsic value and intrinsic worth. It is critical to human success and growth to have a healthy sense of self, a healthy perception of our own worth. Right? So therefore, our thought behavior, our thought, speech, and action, the level of behavior, is motivated, is fueled by the tools that we all have. And every one of us, if we're semi-healthy, have these three tools. The tools of kina, ta'ava, kavod, the tools of jealousy, lust, and pursuit of glory. Where the choice lies, we don't have a choice whether we have them or not. We don't have a choice whether we can be successful or effective or function properly with or without these tools. They are critical to our experience. We must have them. If we want to have any level, any effective success at level one, at thought, speech, and action, at behavior, we must have the tools that fuel that behavior. However, the third level that a person functions at is the driver of all of this. What is driving the jealousy? What is driving the lust? What is driving the pursuit of glory? And that's the level where we have to make that decision. That's our value system, where we create what we call a center, a foundation, that will be the foundation of how the tools of our existence play out, how the jealousy plays out, how the lust plays out, how the pursuit of glory plays out, how it develops, how it evolves. And it's at that level where we can make that choice. And it's at that level where we have to create our life mission statement and our goals, and that has to be the end with which we begin. Is this clear so far? Are we doing all right? Yeah.
But just, I think being able to experience people being very successful in specific things, I can agree that they're always going to be greed, desire, lust. But I don't know about jealousy in pursuit. I've seen people do amazing things with probably no jealousy whatsoever. And really little.
Depends how you define jealousy. You're thinking of negative jealousy. And the definition of negative jealousy is that their driving force is to be better than the other person because they define themselves by the other person, or to take away things from the other person so they can have it. That's negative jealousy. But there's positive jealousy. Positive jealousy is... Or learning from someone. Right? I don't think anyone can operate in isolation. We all, in a healthy way, operate by some level of healthy comparison. Now, I'm not... God forbid, we shouldn't define ourselves by comparing ourselves to other people, because that doesn't work, and we're going to talk about this in a minute. Right? But there is a concept of healthy jealousy, which is learning from others, aspiring to be like others, emulating others, learning the good character traits from other people.
Is that envy?
Well, envy is normally a negative thing, but...
Admiration. I thought it's when you want what someone else has, but you don't want to take it away from
them. Yeah, but that could also be a negative thing. It depends what it is that the person has. Is it materialistic things, or is it personality? Is it traits? Is it strategy? Is it methodology? Is it success? Is it something you can learn from?
So this is what you mean by choice.
Well, the choice is this. You see, the choice is... We don't have a choice whether we have a jealousy or not. We have a choice... What is going to be the foundation that's going to affect how the jealousy develops and what kind of jealousy it's going to have? You know what, let's move on for a few minutes and you'll see. I think it'll become a lot clearer when I develop this third concept.
Sorry, just very quickly, this may sound strange, but are there ways that you can cultivate these tools if you think
you'd be
lacking in a certain...
Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about right now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Because that's where the person, that's where the individual has to create a goal that becomes the defining driver of all the tools that we have. And let me put it to you the way Stephen Covey explains it, and it's so in line with Jewish thought. We all have what he refers to as the center of our existence. In other words, what does our existence revolve around? And there's two kinds of centers that a person can have. Either a person can build a center of his or her life that is based on something on the outside, external. Stay with me for a minute. Or it can be a center that we build that is coming from within. And that's the difference. Let's talk about an external center. An external center can even be a good center sometimes, but it's external. So for example, it can be an individual whose whole life and life decisions centers around his or her spouse, family. Or it can be a much more materialistic center, money, pleasure, control. These are all things of the outside that can be driving the way I operate. So they'll take control, for example. There are people who are obsessed with control. Control freaks. Not necessarily abusive, but control freaks. Right? And therefore all their decisions are based on how they can control and manipulate other people. It's very sad, but this exists. Right? There are certain people that their center is pursuit of materialism. And therefore everything else is an outcome, evolves, is a consequence of that center. The problem with that is that when the center is external, it never brings ultimate happiness. There's always a deficiency. There's always a need for more. When the center is external, it's always very hard to balance. You see, part of the problem that exists, and we dealt with this last series that we did last time, part of the problem that exists with so many people is that the driving force that drives their entire existence is how they are perceived by the outside world and how they are perceived by other people. So much so that they learn to define themselves by what other people think. I'm not sure if we dealt with this last week or not, but... Right? And normally it evolves into a complete mess. There's tension, there's negative jealousy, there's negative lust, There's a pursuit of creating a sort of image. Then there's the balancing. Do I please this one? Do I please that one? Sometimes people have multiple external centers. So therefore, their friends become a very main part of their life. Their spouse, their family, their money, their pursuit of pleasure. And they all have conflicting demands. And it becomes a whole roller coaster of how to try and balance and cater for all the demands that are coming from the outside. And a person evolves into a complete mess. And normally, while sometimes one can achieve some level of success and some level of pleasure, one rarely achieves any level of true, meaningful happiness if the center of one's life is coming from the outside. And normally the defining thing is that when the center of a person's existence is external, then the tools are negative. The jealousy becomes negative. The pursuit of glory is about how I create an image that's perceived by other people, how I pursue that good impression, that approval from other people. I engage in approval-seeking behaviors. A true center, an effective center, a real inward, meaningful center that a person builds for their own life, which becomes the driving force of entire existence, is an internal center. And that's not a center based on the outside, but it's a center based on principles, values, and truths. Whole different mindset. A whole different formula. Now, of course, as Jewish people, that center has a lot to do with the values that we learn from the Torah. And it becomes the values, the principles, become the driving forces. Not the people or the objects on the outside. When the principles and the values are the center of my life, then it's a whole different perspective. Then we learn how to prioritize. Then we don't act on what the demands from the outside dictate, or the pressures from the outside dictate, or the social pressures from the outside dictate, or the desires of the people of the outside dictate. We live our life by principles. And those principles include healthy relationships and pleasing other people and doing kindness, etc., etc. But we have a sort of absolute moral code and a center of a lifestyle that becomes the goal. So therefore, in terms of this habit, when we talk about habit 2, which is to begin with the end in mind, what that really means is to dig very, very deep and to discover and to define what is at the very center of our life. Normally when we do that, we sometimes think we're operating according to the principles that govern our lifestyle, but we get so caught up in the moment that we don't realize that we actually are not. When we think broadly and we start to think about the outcome, what would I like to be, what would I like people to say about me after 100 years, that's a good exercise in terms of their success, materialism, you know, is it good relationships, is it moral living, right? The defining principles become very, very different. So really it's about really self-examination and really trying to understand and identify what are the values of my life, what are the principles of my life, and starting from there. So therefore, the decisions that I make today, what I choose today, and I can choose, as we said last week, the way the decisions and the responsible responses that I will make to any stimulus and to any experience that I make today, I need to ensure that I have the end in mind. What are the ultimate intrinsic principles and values that are the real center of my life? If a person concludes that the center are external centers, then that's obvious, it won't work. But that's what it is. But most people, when they really reflect into it properly, would probably discover that they would desire, they aspire at least, that the center of their life should be internal centers, the values and principles of life. So that's how one goes about with this habit. In other words, the skill of the habit is really to define those principles and values. What are my real values that I tend to forget about and that I tend to ignore when I'm making on-the-spot decisions, when I get totally absorbed in management and not in direction and leadership. Did that become clearer?
Yeah.
Did that become clearer?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Which then leads in to habit number 3. Because what we'll see is that habit number 2 and habit number 3 have to work together. Because habit number 3 is the other side of the coin. Habit number three is about management. Habit number three is about the ladder. You know the wall, now you need to actually put the ladder there. Right? You have the script, but you have to build a building. And essentially, habit three is what today people like to call time management. It's about what do we do with today? What do we do with the now? How do we make the now and the present actually function properly? And then once we've developed this, we'll see that, as we spoke about last week, the first three habits are independence. Remember we spoke last week about independence and interdependence. Independence and dependence, right? And then interdependence. So the first three habits is about building ourselves. Once we've built ourselves, then we can relate to others. So habit three is first things first, he calls it, right? The concept of management, of actually understanding the details and understanding how to make the details and the days that we live actually work well. Now, the focus of our discussion when we talk about managing our time and making it work, of course, is not going to be things like how to keep a diary and how to make appointments, but rather the philosophical concept and the strategies and the principles behind valuing our time and how to make time actually work for us. But let's just give a bit of an introduction, and this is a very, very important introduction and it's a very fundamental life concept. Habit 2 and Habit 3 are incredibly different. And actually, normally would be about two different personalities. What do I mean? See, Habit 2 is forward thinking. It's thinking beyond. It's creative. It's about thinking out of the box. It's about thinking about values and principles, not about details of right now, what do we do? Right? It's about thinking beyond the present. It's about going beyond sort of practical details and into things like values and principles and things like that. Habit 3 is very different, right? Habit 3 is the ability to focus on the nitty-gritty details of every day, of the present. It's about being concrete and tangible, whereas Habit 2 is being more abstract. It's focused on the now, whereas Habit 2 is focused on the beyond. Right? Habit 3 is about being able to break up tasks into various different components, whereas Habit 2 is the overall picture. And the reason why I'm bringing that out to compare those two habits is because we have a Kabbalistic principle, and those that have heard some of the stuff that we've done previously will know this very well, that the person is governed by different emotions, by different tools, by different powers of the soul. And essentially, there's what we call the right side of the personality and the left side of the personality. I'm not talking about right brain, left brain now, which is tied in, but I'm talking about a Kabbalistic principle. And the right side of the personality is the part of the personality we call chesed, which normally loosely translated is like love or kindness. And the left side of the personality is the concept we call gevura, which is more discipline, strictness, firmness, right? And normally, most people have a disposition to one or the other. There's overlap and there's gray areas, but most people are either chesed people or gevura people, right? Not good or bad, just that's the personality. For example, you have certain people who are chesed personalities. So they, for example, they're very flexible, they're very creative, they come up with great ideas, they're so flexible, they'll do anything for anyone, they'll do favors for anyone. But try to get them to an appointment, like reasonably on time. Impossible. Impossible. Right? They cannot hold down, they cannot arrive on time to anything. Right? Totally disorganized, totally all over the place. Fantastic people, and great people, and abstract thinkers, and deep thinkers, but all over the place. Then you have the people who are gevura people, right? Which might even be in a good way. In other words, they might be very sort of disciplined people. It's an inward thing. In fact, it's almost inflexible, but they're very reliable. Those are the people you want to depend on them for something. You don't ask a chesed person.
Philosophers and physicists.
Almost, exactly. Something like that, right? Right? On the other hand, the problem with those people is that they cannot think beyond the now. And they're not so flexible. And when their schedule gets messed up, we're in trouble, right? The whole world falls apart because they're very focused on the nitty-gritty, very focused on management. Now, we know in businesses this is true. Right? We know in business management, we have sometimes people have the fantastic ideas and they're incredibly creative and they come up with a product and an idea and an approach, but they're hopeless at management, so the business fails. And then you get people who are so good at management, but they're so closed to new concepts that when new concepts are necessary, they're completely trapped. They run a good show, but they're completely trapped because they can't move forward. Right? So you wanted to ask something? No. So these are two different types of personalities. But what we learn, particularly in Jewish thought, is that part of the unique power of a person, of a human being, to make decisions, as we spoke about last week, part of the unique strength of a person to be able to make decisions that is not necessarily in line with our personality, gives us the ability to have both chesed and gevurah. To have both. Because in any human experience, you actually need both. We must think big. We must think of the ultimate goal. We must think abstract. We must have a set of principles and values that govern our life. We must be able to think about what is the end result, the destination, the plan, the script. But we also must be able to focus on the detail. We must be able to put it into place. We must be able to make it work today. And therefore those two habits are the chesed and the gevurah. Habit two is the abstract, the flexible, the creative habit. The ability to think completely abstract and to dig deep and to go beyond and to think above the rationale and to actually deep down into consciousness and talk about the end result and the script and the plan and the end goals. But habit three is about making the day, the now work. Because although we said before that it's not good when people are only caught up in the now, because you have to begin with the end in mind, but once you've done that, then you actually have to understand and appreciate the now and make the now work. And therefore that's the contrast between the two habits, but they're both critical. And they both, at the end of the day, are based on habit one. They both come and evolve from the belief and the conviction that we're in control of ourselves. So therefore we can move into one or the other. We can set aside time and we can withdraw and completely forget about the now and develop the ultimate goal, develop our personal mission statement and develop our principles and our centers, our internal centers of our life and our experiences. But then we can also flip into the gevurah mode and we can actually focus on the detail and we can make it work. For some, habit two will be easier than habit three. For some, habit three will be easier than habit two. But we all need to learn how to do both. So let's develop a little bit the concept of habit three. And let's develop a bit of a Jewish perspective on time management, on managing our time. The first, it's an incredible thing, going back to, again, with the birth of the Jewish nation, when we were created as a nation before we left Egypt. I don't know if you know this, but the very first commandment that the Jewish people received as a nation was the commandment to sanctify time. It was actually the mitzvah of a calendar, to make a calendar, and it was the concept of sanctifying the first day of every month and the broader idea of valuing the time that we have. Valuing the time that we have means to ensure that every day is valued. Every moment is valued. The concept of understanding that every opportunity that we have, every day, is another world. I heard from my grandfather a beautiful analogy. He used to say like this. He used to say that in Poland, where he came from, there were two kinds of calendars. There was a day calendar and a wall calendar. A day calendar was like that each day had a page and you would, when the day was finished, you'd turn the page, you'd rip off the page and go to the next page. A wall calendar had all the days in boxes and when the day was finished, you'd tick it. He said, what was the difference between the two calendars? He said, the difference was that the day calendar that was on the desk, when a day was finished, you tore it up, you crunched it up and you threw it in the garbage and the day disappeared. He said, the wall calendar was one where you have the day of the month. When it was finished, you ticked it, and the day remained. Right? In fact, in this week's weekly parsha, called Chayasara, there's an interesting verse, and it talks about Abraham becoming of age, and it says that Avraham Avinu, Abraham, our father, was Zaken, he was old, Ba Beyamim, he came with his days. So the commentary is asked, what kind of expression is that? What do you mean he came with his days? He was old, I understand. It means he was older. He was 100 years old. Well, at that point, he was 140 already. But what does it mean he came with his days? And the commentaries explain that you can have a person who is old in age, but doesn't come with their days. In other words, the days were not kept. The days disappeared. They were wasted. Abraham Avinu, he's Zaken Baba Yamim. He was old, but not only was he old in his passport, he was old Baba Yamim. He came with each of his days. He had what to show for each day. Each day was a world. Each day was accomplished. Each day was something that was of value. And that's the first mitzvah that we have as a nation, this concept of understanding the sanctity of time, understanding the value of each and every single day. So how do we actually do that? How do we do this practically? How do we fill our days with meaning and purpose? How do we sort of manage our time effectively? So I'm going to share with you five strategies, and this is the terms of the skill of this habit. The first one is one that Stephen Covey talks about, and it's a beautiful little model, and I think it's quite a famous model, but it's worth going through. And he talks about the four, you have it there on your handout, the four quadrants. Our time, our life is divided into four parts, four boxes. Urgent and important. Not urgent, but important. That's quadrant two. Sorry, I should have numbered them. The first one is urgent and important. Number two is not urgent on the right over there, but important. Number three is urgent, but not important. Number four is not urgent and not important. Yeah. So let's try and define them. Generally speaking, if something's important, it's connected to habit two. Meaning, if something's important, it's because it connects to our intrinsic values, our mission statement. So something might be important. It might be important that I spend time with my children, that I have a healthy family, that I have a healthy relationship with my wife. Right? All these things are important. That I do kindness, that I pray, that I study, that I further my education. All these things, they're not pressing today, they're not pressing now, they're not urgent necessarily, but they're important because important things is that list of things that link directly to the second habit, to our mission statement, to the goal, the end that we have in mind. Urgent are things that are now, are needed to be done now. Right? You know, paying an overdue electricity bill is urgent. It might not necessarily link into my ultimate values, but it's important. It's urgent. It needs to be done now. If you want to have some light at least, right? So let's try and fit things into these four quadrants. So urgent and important are things like crises, right? So something happens at work. If you don't attend to it immediately, you could lose your job. Having a job is important. Sustaining oneself is important. It needs to be done now, so it's a crisis, it needs to be right away. Right? You need challah for Shabbos, and Glicks is about to close in 3 seconds. Right? It's exactly. It's urgent and it's important. It's important to have challah for Shabbos. Having a Shabbos meal is an important thing. Lack of planning, perhaps, makes it urgent now. It didn't have to be urgent, but it is, because if I don't act in the next 5 seconds, I won't have it. Things that I cannot survive unless I do it now. Or it will be hard to survive with it. Then we have things in quadrant two which are not urgent but important. And again, those are the things that link into habit two. So, this might be deepening my relationships. It might be health. It might be exercise. It might be spiritual experiences. It might be bonding with my children. It might be personal study. All of these things, they might not be urgent right now, but they're important. These are the things that are really, really important. Then we have things that are in quadrant three that are urgent but not important. Right. Urgent and not important, which means there's that annoying phone that's sort of now rung for the 17th time, and when you pick it up eventually, it's a telemarketer from India, you know, trying to sort of desperate to get a hold of you. Right. Not important, but it became urgent. You just have to get it, you have to stop it ringing. Right? It's pressing, things that are just pressing, but they don't really contribute to the overall goal in any way. So it's urgent, but it's not important. And then quadrant four, those things which are not important and not urgent. And those are all the time-wasting things that we do. You know, excessive TV watching, I don't know, sitting around wasting time, going to meetings that are ineffective, All those things that waste a lot of time. Those are the things that are not important and not urgent. So here's the trick. What's the most important quadrant, of course? Out of these four? Sorry? I didn't say what's the most urgent. I said what's the most important quadrant? Quadrant two. Right? We all agree. Because if we have habit two, meaning if we have an overall goal, if we have an address, if we have a destination of where we want to reach, it's the list of things that are in quadrant two that are going to contribute mostly to our goal. And therefore those are the things that become most important. Or should be most important. It doesn't mean that we have to spend a whole day doing them, but they're the most important.
But one is both urgent and important.
Yeah, but you see, the problem with urgent is that it's urgent because it's urgent, it actually takes, it might be urgent and important, but the urgency takes away from the importance. Because no one wants to attend to the important things. It doesn't really contribute to the goal effectively when it becomes urgent. It's much deeper when it's done properly, right? In other words, for example, I'll give you an example. If someone has a very healthy relationship with their child and has dedicated a lot of time to the relationships in their life, let's take relationships as an example, right? So that's important, right? Someone who hasn't done that, and then suddenly, when the kid's a teenager, there's a real crisis, and he realizes, oi, I'm in trouble now. So it's still part of the goal because it's got to do with relationships, right? But it's only urgent because it wasn't attended to properly in quadrant two. You know what I'm saying? You see, if you think about something that's really important to you that you haven't spent a lot of time on, and inevitably, that thing will be in quadrant two. It's because you haven't spent enough time on it because it's not urgent, but it's really, really important to you. And that's the problem. The problem is that the quadrant that is most important is quadrant two, and that's the one that gets most ignored. Okay? And what happens is like this. What happens is like this. The more we neglect quadrant two, the more quadrant one tends to grow. And quadrant three. Okay? But the more we enlarge quadrant two, the bigger quadrant two becomes, the smaller quadrant one becomes. However, the trick is, in order to make quadrant two bigger, we need to steal from quadrant four. You get that formula? Okay? Yeah, sure, no problem. So the smaller quadrant two becomes, in other words, the more it gets neglected, right? The bigger number one becomes. Because things that are important and are not developed and nurtured eventually become urgent. And when they're urgent, they're not dealt with effectively. So the bigger quadrant two becomes, the smaller number one becomes. The smaller quadrant two is, the bigger number one will be.
She's saying, don't start learning the more on your deathbed. Do it earlier.
Not in that, but yeah. But,
just
yeah.
As an example.
Right. But in order to make quadrant two bigger, in order to dedicate time, we have to learn to steal from quadrant three and particularly quadrant four. In other words, we have to dedicate. We have to make a list of what are those things that fit into quadrant two, which are the things based on habit two, which are our goals, are things that are in line and will contribute to our overall mission. But on a more practical level, what are the things that I do now that will contribute to the end goal? And ensure that we have dedicated times to nurture and develop those things that are in quadrant two. And in order to do that, of course, it comes into the next strategy of the five strategies, which is the idea of discipline. The idea of discipline, meaning being disciplined to our schedule, being disciplined to the way we run our life, being disciplined to the way we manage every day, and even the discipline which some people find so hard, the discipline to learn how to say no. That is a very, very difficult habit. The discipline to say, But I cannot do this now. I cannot even do what you want me to do now because I have such an important, dedicated time to spend now on things that belong to quadrant two. That's crucial. Most people don't know how to say no. And by the way, most people don't know how to say no because it goes very deep. You know why most people don't know how to say no? Because it goes back to the very way we define ourselves. It is crucial to do favors for other people. It is crucial to talk to other people. It is crucial to be polite to other people. It is crucial to be kind to other people. But it is not crucial to do all of those things if it's all based because I need approval from other people. Kindness must be solid kindness. It must be kindness that contributes to the goal. It's got to be real and sincere kindness. And sometimes kindness means that I say no to a stranger because my family needs me first. Kindness means that I say no to an empty sort of experience so I can dedicate time to a more meaningful one. That doesn't mean that recreation is bad or having a good time is bad. On the contrary, it's important. All four quadrants have to exist. It's just a question of proportion.
And learning how to say no to yourself is probably the hardest thing.
Right, right. Discipline means also the discipline to fight procrastination. Right? So one of the biggest diseases that plague a lot of people is the idea of procrastinating. I once saw a time management video and he gave a brilliant strategy for procrastination. He called it the salami method. Salami method is if there's something you don't want to do, but you know it's so important, right? Because those are the things that we often just, you know, are difficult. And it's all kinds of, it's a whole another discussion of why people procrastinate. They maybe have a fear of failure, they have a laziness, there's spiritual reasons, all kinds of different explanations of why people procrastinate. But there's normally the things we don't want to do, but those things are particularly important. Right? So he gave it a salami method. Salami method, just like a salami you cut into very, very thin slices, take a task that you don't want to do. The Talmud tells us that all beginnings are difficult. It's normally just the beginning that's so hard. So what you do is you say, I'm going to do this for 3 minutes. That's it. I'm going to break it down into bite sizes, small components, and do them. Normally when you've had a taste of success and you've done it well for 3 minutes, you're ready to take the next slice of the salami. But you break it down. So it's all these ideas that have to do with the discipline of actually managing our time. But it's the discipline that comes with the dedication of being dedicated to quadrant two. That will come what may, I need to set aside that so many times we go through weeks and months, we know what's important, we have at the back of our consciousness those principles and values that we know are important to our lives, but we haven't implemented it because we get so caught up in the routine and the rush of life that we come at the end of months and we say, you know, we haven't dedicated enough time for those important things. So it's about making a list of what fits into quadrant two and then making a disciplined attempt of dedicating resources, energy, effort, and time, particularly to that quadrant. The third strategy is a crucial one. It's the ability to live in the moment. Now, what does living in the moment mean? Not to be confused for living for the moment, right? We certainly, as meaningful people, hopefully, do not live for the moment, because that goes in contradiction with everything that we've said. We actually don't live for the moment. We live for an ultimate goal. We live for a destination. We live for the script that we've set ourselves out for, for that goal that we've developed, for those principles that we've created. So we don't live for the moment, but we have to learn to live in the moment. You know, I'm sure many of you would experience this, because, and I'm, my personality, this is a big effort because I'm very disposed to this. Always, when you're doing something, always worrying about the next thing that you got to do. Always worrying about the next thing that has to happen tomorrow, right? And we never get to actually fully maximize the potential of where we are now, right? I tell a story. The Lubavitch Rebbe once told the following story about his father-in-law, the previous Lubavitch Rebbe. And he said that one time his father-in-law had to travel to the capital city, to St. Petersburg at that time, it was called Petersburg, for a very, very crucial meeting with government officials that had to do with the very political situation of the Jews in Russia, which was very, very sensitive at the time and very delicate and very vulnerable. And it was like a lot depended on that meeting, a lot for the goodness of the Jewish community depended on that meeting. So he had to catch a train at a particular time to travel to St. Petersburg for that particular meeting. So you can imagine all person would be terribly nervous and you need to make the train and it's got to be important and it's crucial that we make this meeting, etc. Half an hour before he was supposed to catch the train, the Rebbe tells a story that he walked into his father-in-law's study. And he saw him engrossed in something, as if there's no tomorrow. He was completely not nervous about his trip that he had to make. He was completely and utterly absorbed in something that he was studying at that moment. And he tells the story, he says that he was completely dumbfounded by this. And he said to his father-in-law, he said, how do you manage? Like, how can you do that? Aren't you nervous about a train? Like, you know, we normally before a trip, for me it happens like 3 days before. Like, I'm always like nervous about the making sure I'm at the airport. My wife always laughs at me that I need to be 3.5 hours before the plane. You know, most people go 2 hours before. Right? So he said to his father-in-law, how do you do this? So he said like this. He says, we cannot make our days any longer, nor can we add additional hours to our nights. But we can maximize our usage of time by regarding each segment of time as a world of its own. When we devote a portion of time, whether it's an hour, a day, or a minute, to a certain task, we should be totally invested in what we are doing as if there exists nothing else in the world. And that's a real skill. That's the real secret to real time management. Not to live for the moment, but to live in the moment. In other words, when we translate our goals into tasks and experiences and missions and things that we have to do today, when we do them, we have to be totally absorbed. It's got to do also with relationships. When we talk to someone, we cannot be thinking about the other person we have to talk. When we're listening to someone, we have to be fully there, fully present in what we're doing. And that's an incredible and critical skill in terms of getting the maximum value out of each day, doing the things that will ultimately contribute to our ultimate goal. And the fourth strategy, of course, is flexibility. But at the end of the day, we have to have that other side as well, where we are dedicated to our schedule, we are disciplined to the day, we are disciplined to getting the maximum value out of the day, but we also know that we're not in control, and the day always doesn't always work out the way we want it to be. And that if something goes wrong, we have enough presence of mind and enough power of the human decision-making process and responsible process to change course and to say, okay, it didn't quite work it out, let me reassess, let me regroup, and let me replan the day. And of course, the fifth one is what I call the cycle of the three habits. In order to make this successful, what we have to be doing all the time is revisiting all of the three habits. Because what happens is, as we said before, the ability to focus on the goal and the ability to focus on the details of the now are very, very different. And they all have to be in line with the first habit, which is the unique power that we are in control of ourselves to make those decisions. And therefore, the only way it can really work is by constantly revisiting those habits, by constantly reflecting on the first habit of being proactive, that in fact we are in control and we do make that decision and we can respond the way we choose to respond. By then reflecting on our life goals and beginning with the end in mind, but then translating that into an effective management strategy of actually getting the maximum value of our time. But as we do that, the danger then is we can then slip in to the management mode and become completely absorbed in the now and forget about the future, so that we have to keep revisiting the habit two and then translating it to habit three and keep going around that cycle. In other words, those first three habits have to work together and work in a cycle that keeps going round and round, and only then it works. So that's the concepts of the first three habits. And as I said before, these first three habits really complete the first section of what human development and success and effectiveness is all about, because it's about building the personality, building the person from within. It's about building and believing in our power to take control and be responsible. It's about having that goal, and it's about effective management. Once we can do that, and we've built the personality from within, then we can now take it through and make it work in the way we relate to the world, and especially to other people. And that will be the theme of the next three habits, which, please God, will continue on next week. Same place, same time. Have a great night. Any questions? Yes, please.
Related to last week's lesson. We spoke about being proactive and how that means if you can choose how you react to something. Is it being proactive being the one to make a decision in the first place and not reacting to something?
I'm not sure I read your question. Therefore,
my question is that proactivity and choosing how we react to a situation, isn't that really being reactive?
Oh, I see. No, it depends how you translate the word proactive. We have no choice a lot of times. We have to react to something. But reactive means doing it in an impulsive way. Because I think the concept is this. When we're proactive in the sense that you're thinking of, then a lot of times we avoid those situations that would require that response in the first place. I understand. But that doesn't work. Because what we need to understand is that at the end of the day, we don't control the external stimuli. And there will always be situations that we couldn't avoid. There will always be that traffic jam, no matter how much you plan, there will always be that traffic jam that you respond to. No matter how well you build your relationship, there's always going to be that person that comes and says something that's going to push your buttons. There's always going to be that stimulus from the outside that could elicit a negative response. And being proactive means that you don't react in a way where it's impulsive and instinctive, but you actually make a decision of how you respond. Right? And the way we've developed it over the last 2 weeks means that it's actually a lot deeper than that. It's about making those decisions based on a really deep principles and values that we've built for ourselves to be the guiding forces of our life. Yep.
It's a simple question, but essentially the main point is that we need to control ourselves. That's the point that we want. We need to be in control of ourselves.
Right.
We are in control of ourselves. Does the source of the Tom River tell us anything about how that affects our ability to control our environment? If we control ourselves and continually get better, does that mean that we control our environment?
We don't control our environment, but we influence our environment. We spoke about this last week, that when we concentrate on the circle of influence, i.e. ourselves, then the circle of concern becomes smaller. We developed this last week. I don't think you were there.
Yeah.
So, you never control the outside, but you inspire and influence the outside. And that's the inward-outward approach, where if you start with yourself, you have a much better chance of not controlling or manipulating, because that's not what it's about, but about having an influence and inspiring the outside. Yep.
It strikes me, number three, living in the moment, that when we little kids, we really do that. We don't agonize about what
Correct.
We could be, what we should have, what we could have, and we really deal with the moment, and somewhere we lose it along the way.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, there are a lot of things that we do really well as little kids, and I don't know what happens to it later. I mean, there's an amazing amount of stuff to learn from kids. Optimism, a lot of times kids have a spunk and a joy and they seem to lose that later. A lot of things happen. And it has to do with our environment, it has to do with the way we live, and it has to do with the values of society that have an impact on us. And, sorry?
Conditioning.
Conditioning, it has to do with conditioning. What this is all about is understanding that the conditioning doesn't govern us, so we can rise above it. Yeah.
We're learning a lot of things, good things.
I'm sorry, we're learning a lot of? Right.
Sure.
I think there's a knowledge, attitude, and skill. I think the concept is like this. You know, for many years I was a high school teacher, a high school principal. I was into education. We used to go to a lot of teaching seminars and in-service training. And I think this is true with everything. I once read a bit of research about how effective is in-service training and you know staff training is like that. And they said that if you don't put at least one idea into practice within the first 48 hours, it doesn't. It's worth it. I think it's about bite sizes. You know, we have to have reasonable expectations, right? But you're right. But the concept of habit, at the end of the day, habit is a behavior, right? Which is driven by knowledge, as we spoke about last week, and attitude and skill. The way to make this work, for example, from tonight, is actually to practically go and dedicate half an hour to making a plan to implement some of this stuff. For example, to actually, pen and paper, by the way, is a great thing, right? A lot of times we have a lot of thoughts, but until we put them down into an actual list, it actually doesn't crystallize. It would be a great idea if we went away and actually sat down 50 minutes and said, what are the principles and values that govern my life? What is it? What do I want to make, not what I do, but what do I want to make my decisions based on, right? And then to actually translate into management and say, well, if that's the case, I built my quadrant two. Over the next week, let me block off on the diary a couple of times, even if it's 20 minutes, that I'm going to do things that are not urgent, but are specifically directed to the things that are important. And make, in a small, reasonable expectation type framework, not unreasonable, but something small. When you put something into practice on a level of behavior, it's very, very powerful. Because the Talmud teaches us also that the behavior that influences the heart. When you put something into action, it then has a backfire effect into the way we feel and the way we believe. So we believe something, we have an attitude something, we learn the skill, we put it into practice, it reinforces the attitude. And then we make that plan. So you're 100% right, I thank you for bringing that up. It will be a great thing if we go away from it and actually put something, even one thing, into practice. Make one list and dedicate half an hour to that you wouldn't have otherwise done to strengthen that quadrant too. Or for 1 hour tomorrow, try and not think about what's going to happen after that. I'll just be totally involved in what you're doing. Or, you know, that kind of thing. Take one thing and try and make it work. Good. Thank you.